say we're young and we don't know. Won't find out till we grow. Well, I don't know if all that's true, 'cause you got me, baby, I got you.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Phil? Phil Connors?
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Back off, man. I'm a scientist.
And TK.
Phil? Phil Connors?
Today, the date we are recording this is Groundhog Day, and thanks to a listener suggestion, we figured this would be the perfect opportunity to talk about an actor who is almost universally beloved, the star of Groundhog Day, the one, the only, Bill Murray. I'm kind of amazed that we've never dedicated an episode to this guy, because he turns up in our pantheon of great films several times. He's definitely a favorite. He's got an entire cult following. So on this show, we're going to be talking about all things Bill Murray, our thoughts on his career, our favorite Murray performances, and more right after this. The Back Row is dedicated to delivering free entertainment to everyone in the forms of media culture blogging, movie reviews, short films, podcasts, and more. That's awesome, I hear you exclaim, and you're right, it is pretty awesome. So why don't you help us out by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and leaving a review? Just search the iTunes store for Shouts from the Back Row to subscribe to our feed. And if you're feeling generous, visit the-back-row.com and click the donate button to send us a few bucks. Your support means the world to us. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So TK, what have you been up to?
I've been fairly busy, so I haven't actually had that much time to do anything, although I have been catching up with season 3 of House of Cards, which I started and then stopped, and this restarted again. I know I'm a season behind. I know season 5 is actually coming up fairly soon, but I just really wanted to catch up. And Frank Underwood is delightful to watch as always. There's just something about him I just can't stop watching. Kevin Spacey makes him both malicious and evil and highly watchable. I can't get enough of it.
I'm kind of amazed that you haven't caught up with House of Cards yet. I remember you just absolutely loved the show in its first couple of seasons.
Oh, and that hasn't changed. I'm still really enjoying it. I think, actually, I'll have a better idea in a week or two whenever I blow through the rest of the season, start on season 4, about how I feel about it in the whole series right now. But I like the second season a lot, but it's fun watching him wheel and deal and try and get everything together, especially because I think in this one he's campaigning right now, which is a lot of fun to watch. So it's pretty cool. I'm enjoying it.
So here's the thing. They recently released a trailer for season 5 of House of Cards coming out soon. And I gotta say, given the political climate of the real world these days, somehow I feel like watching House of Cards is going to, like, I'm just going to see it through a totally different lens, because while Frank Underwood is definitely like this sinister character and he's just going to do everything in his power to get, like, to be the most powerful man in the world, basically, to become the U.S. president, he's really subdued and a lot more likable, I think, than the actual U.S. president, Donald Trump. And he certainly isn't just like, he's not nearly as bombastic. It's like it's the inverse. It's a case of reality being like too overwritten, and then a show seeming almost too real and too grounded by comparison. I don't know. What are your thoughts, TK, watching House of Cards now with Donald Trump as president and just all the crazy things going on?
I'd vote for Frank Underwood in a heartbeat. I think. Just in terms of, I've been one of those people who I can't watch any news that has anything to do with the post-election. I can't do it because I get so angry I can't think. And so for my well-being, yeah. I've been I hear obviously about what's going on, but like I try not to read as much into it because I know I'll just drive myself crazy thinking about it. So I've been very much ostriching.
To forget about politics and the U.S. president and the election, you've decided to watch House of Cards.
Yeah, to make me feel better.
Oh, my God.
And other than that, gentlemen, that's all I've been up to.
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I finally got to see one of my most anticipated films of 2016, which didn't get a theatrical release here until the first weeks of 2017, and that's The Founder, starring Michael Keaton. And I'm happy to say I enjoyed it quite a bit. I don't know if this one will win any Oscars or get any awards, but it is a great tour de force for Michael Keaton. He gives yet another outstanding performance in this one. It's just a tailor-made role for him because his character, Ray Kroc, like, he's obviously like an unethical slime ball who does like a lot of terrible things to people, but Keaton somehow finds a way to make him kind of likable and admirable at times, because even though you know that he's a bastard, you just kind of have this strange admiration for like his drive and his work ethic and stuff like that. And and the fact that he's playing like a real life individual and you're just kind of not sure what to feel about him is just a great testament to Keaton's performance. And he pretty much is like the highlight of the film, but the film itself is very, very good. I just found it like really fascinating just to see the whole history of McDonald's and just the way that it started off as this one little like popular restaurant in a town in California and run by these two very likable, like honest brothers. I think Nick Offerman and John Carroll Lynch are also outstanding in their roles, playing these very idealistic guys who do not want to sacrifice the quality of their work to make more money and are easily manipulated by like this sociopathic businessman. And it's just kind of, they have this like long section near the beginning where like the brothers are explaining over the course of 10 to 15 minutes like how the concept of McDonald's and fast food and drive-through restaurants like came about. It's really, really fascinating to watch. And then of course you see Ray Kroc take over their idea and turn it into like the most popular restaurant in the world. So it's pretty enjoyable to watch. I'm kind of sad that they kind of threw it out there in like early January, so that it's kind of like in the wasteland of cinema, so it'll probably be forgotten around award season next year, because I really want Michael Keaton to get his long overdue Oscar finally, but I don't know if he'll win it for this performance. But he's really good in it, and I definitely check it out. I know the cinema is kind of a barren wasteland right now. There's not a lot of good new movies coming out, but The Founder is kind of a breath of a fresh air, and I highly recommend you check it out.
That's great. I mean, I've been hearing basically two things about this movie ever since it came out, which is Michael Keaton is great in it, but there's not a lot of story. That seems to be the main complaint. It's just like, it seems that perhaps to some critics a bit meandery, but it seems like everybody can agree that Michael Keaton is really good. And if I make my way out to the cinema anytime soon and I'm forced to pick between The Bye Bye Man and The Founder, I will definitely pick The Founder.
Oh, yes, definitely. Unfortunately, The Bye Bye Man, it looks like, has made a lot more money than The Founder. Oh. Right? It doesn't look like The Founder has made much money at the box office, but definitely worth checking out. And a lot of my other time recently has been occupied by something very exciting. Unsolved Mysteries is back on the internet again. You've probably heard me rant about this over the years, but it's old production company Cosgrove and Muir, like, did everything in their power to ensure that Unsolved Mysteries could not be viewed anywhere online. Like, the minute somebody uploaded them to YouTube, they pounce in and, like, pull them off and stuff, and it was just so impossible to watch good quality versions of it. Like, I had my bootlegs that were burned to DVD, but they were, like, copies of, like, fourth generation VHSs that were taped off a TV, like, 20 years ago, but thankfully, very recently, this company called FilmRise acquired the digital online distribution rights to Unsolved Mysteries from Cosgrove Muir, and they have finally released them. They're now currently available on Amazon Prime. They're working slowly and gradually. Right now, they only have season one available on there, but that's because they're doing like some great remastering jobs season by season. So I think they're releasing maybe one season per month until they get them all out there. But it's just kind of a revelation to watch these old segments and see them in such good quality. Like, they've done a masterful job at like restoring the picture quality, and it's so great to see like classic Robert Stack there online, just being able to watch it at the touch of a button. And what's also great is that they put, they've added text updates to the end of segments. So if there was any of these mysteries have been solved or there's been a revelation in the last couple years, they actually put it on there at the very end. So you know what happens in the case. And it's also a good thing for The Trail Went Cold, because some of our episodes are unsolved mysteries cases, which were shown in the very first season. And just as an example, we did an episode on the murder of a woman named Doreen Picard, which aired on Unsolved Mysteries in 1988, I think. And at the end, they just put this brief text update saying that, oh, a man named Raven Tempest was convicted of the murder, but he got released in 2015. But they don't put many details there. But if anyone wanted to find out more information, just Google the names and they'll find The Trail Went Cold and get to listen to my podcast about it, where I go into full detail which happened to that case. So I'd like to think that The Trail Went Cold, its popularity kind of played a role and getting Unsolved Mysteries back on the internet and showing that, yeah, that's my fantasy at least, and just showing that people still want to watch this stuff, that these cases are still popular. So it's great for the podcast and fans of true crime in general that Unsolved Mysteries is back online. And I know that I've been binging the first season, and I know that once they keep adding the seasons, I'll probably go through the whole run, which will be great because there are some segments I still have not seen or have not seen in many, many years. So pretty exciting. 2017 has gotten off to a great start.
Man, yeah, I should start rewatching that. I only have the vaguest memories of watching it when I was little and being scared out of my mind by it. But it has been a long time since I've actually watched the show.
And it still holds up pretty well. A lot of its production values are still pretty scary today. And you'll probably find it interesting just to see the original Unsolved Mystery segments about some of the cases I've covered, because you've edited them together and know the story, and now you can kind of see where they originated from. So, pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of,
I just want to watch the episode where Matthew McConaughey is the killer. That's all I want to watch.
Yeah, it comes in like 1992, so I think there's still a couple more seasons before you get that far. But I'll let you know the minute it's on Amazon Prime, so you can see him mowing the lawn in like jean shorts and a cutoff t-shirt. And as far as The Trail Went Cold, we actually did our first interview released just this past Monday. I kind of teased on our last episode about when I was talking about the true crime podcast Suspect Convictions that we were doing a tie-in for it. And the reason is representatives of that podcast actually approached The Trail Went Cold and asked if we would interview Scott Reeder, who's like a journalist of about 30 years who lives in Springfield, Illinois, and covered the murder case that is covered on Suspect Convictions. And he's an integral part of the podcast. He was the one who got it all started and is writing a book about it. And he took the time out to do a interview with us via Skype, and we recorded it and released it on Monday, and it's fascinating to check out. He's such a great storyteller and has such great insight into this case and the controversial trials that surrounded it. So if you want to listen to our interview with him, and you could kind of use it as a lead into listen to Suspect Convictions, which is an excellent podcast in its own right. It's on episode 7 now, and what's interesting about it is that it's going to be unfolding in real time, because the trial they're covering is actually happening in May. So the ending of that trial, the verdict in that trial, is going to be the ending of their podcast. So we have no idea where it's going to go. So I'd recommend you check out our interview and also listen to Suspect Convictions, because I guarantee you'll be hooked by it. And yeah, that's about all I've been up to.
We should note that if any listeners are interested in checking out The Trail Went Cold, they can find it at trailwentcold.com or through the-back-row.com. So as far as what I've been up to, the Royal Cinema here in Toronto recently put on a great double bill, and I watched Westworld and Future World back-to-back. And it's in light of the new HBO series, I thought it would be really fun to revisit these two and also to see if they would give me any insight into what might be coming up in season 2 of Westworld, which unfortunately we're not getting until something like 2018. And I had seen the movie Westworld before, but I'd never seen Future World. And it stars Peter Fonda, so I was kind of intrigued, and it's also longer than Westworld. I was really curious to see what it might bring to the table, and why people seem to like it a whole lot less than Westworld. And so, well, my thoughts on Westworld, the first one, are that it's kind of like a perfect little, you know, retro sci-fi movie. It's not very long, the plot is extremely simple, and it hints at a surprising amount of stuff that has made it into the TV series. TK, you of course watch the show Westworld, and I know you've seen the movie. How long ago was it that you saw the movie?
Not long. I saw it whenever we did our Western podcast.
That's right. So what do you think of the comparison between the movie and the show?
I think the show is built off a very rich idea that the film put out. I think there's a lot of like little ideas that slowly came together that made the show really interesting. So, and I think that all of them germinated in the film.
There are all these like little these offhanded mentions to things that then become this big deal within the TV show. Like the one specifically is the scientists, the behind the scenes guys of Westworld, are talking about how something's going wrong with the robots and they're starting to like malfunction and just disobey orders, and they think that it might be some kind of, like, they call it like a disease for machines. Basically, they were coming up with the idea of a computer virus before such a thing existed in like our reality, because this was made in the 70s, so computer viruses weren't quite a thing at the time. So then, of course, in the HBO series, that virus is like this thing that's slowly giving the android sentience. It's really neat to see how they spin the ideas, like the background lore of the movie Westworld, into this intricate, you know, multi-episode puzzle box with all these twists and turns, and you know, who's real and who's not. Like, that's a sort of passing question in the movie. But in the show, it becomes like this fundamental plot point, is that you can't tell who's a robot and who's a human being. And then there's Future World. And I can totally see why this one is not as popular. They don't spend a lot of time in any of the parks. Here's the difference between Westworld the movie and Westworld the TV series. There are multiple parks, but it seems like Future World isn't one of them in the show. So far, we only know that there are two parks, and they haven't, I don't know, maybe Future World will turn up at some point. But really what the movie is about is Peter Fonda and his sidekick, basically, like his love interest. They're investigative journalists, and so they want to get behind-the-scenes scoop on the Westworld, Future World, Roman World, Medieval World series of theme parks. So sadly, most of their time is spent like in the underground facility where all these parks are controlled. So it's just a lot of like dingy hallways and industrial looking, you know, rooms full of pipes and things like that. They briefly go into a few of the parks, but they really don't spend a lot of time there. However, this is another case of the HBO series borrowing a whole lot of the lore that's sort of hinted at. In particular, and I'll say spoilers for Westworld the TV show, but we see some samurai robots in this one, which they briefly make an appearance late in the season of the first season of Westworld. And also there's a lot of talk of Delos being the company, like the corporation that owns all the theme parks. And in the HBO series, Delos is this corporation that's trying to basically buy out Westworld and take it over for their own devices. So again, just like really interesting ideas seated in there, but Future World is a vastly inferior film. It really the best thing I can say about it is that, you know, you get this insight into the wider lore of this world. But sadly, you don't really get to see it. You know, they don't spend enough time in those fantasy worlds, which is what we come to see. Also, one last thing about Westworld that I noticed. Of course, Westworld was written and directed by Michael Crichton. And since it's about a theme park where the exhibits run amok and start killing people, it's obviously his prototype for Jurassic Park. And So of course there are all the, like, there are those similarities, but one similarity, like one thing that he definitely carried over into Jurassic Park that I did not expect is, in Westworld, Yul Brynner is this android that they just called the Gunslinger, and he's basically the T-Rex style character. He's like the main monster. And both he and the T-Rex have a weird thing going on with their sight, with their vision. Brynner's character, the robot has, thermal vision, infravision, and the protagonist uses that to outwit the robot. And of course, the T-Rex has vision based on movement, and that's used to outwit the T-Rex. So I just thought that that was a neat little plot point that carried through into Jurassic Park as well, that I was not really expecting. So there you go, Westworld and Future World. It is a great double bill, especially if you're watching the TV series. Robin, have you seen either or both of these movies?
Oh, I've seen the original Westworld, the movie, but not for a long, long time, and I've never seen Future World, but I plan to at least revisit Westworld when I start watching the TV series.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to watch the HBO series. It's always fun. It is one of those TV shows that, like, is sort of built on puzzles and theories, and it's really fun to discuss with people, as TK and I have done on this podcast in the past.
Oh, I'm sure we can devote an entire podcast to it once I begin watching it.
Definitely. And I also watched a couple of recent movies. I finally got around to watching Moana, the new film from Disney Animation Studios, and it's up for Best Animated Feature and I think Best Song as well. And this is the sort of Polynesian Disney princess movie fairy tale, drawing on, you know, Polynesian and Maori folklore and things like that, all this just interesting island culture that they did a lot of consultation on. I hear director Taika Waititi, who I'm a big fan of, he directed Hunt for the Wilder People, he's, you know, New Zealand director, he consulted on the film as well. And it's a typical Disney story where, you know, the princess in this isolated location, she dreams of something bigger, she meets up with, like, a magical sidekick, oh, and there's also, like, a cute animal sidekick too, and they go on a big adventure and, you know, have all these encounters and musical numbers along the way. It's like one part Aladdin, one part, you know, Disney princess, maybe Beauty and the Beast to some degree. So in this one, Moana is the princess of this island village, but she wants to go sailing. She wants to, like, travel on the ocean and see what lies beyond. And when hard times fall upon her village, she takes off on a boat to find the demigod Maui, played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson, so he can basically set things right with his magical powers. And they have to, like, retrieve Maui's, you know, magical fish hook from a giant crab, and they battle with pirates, and it's, you know, hijinks and adventure, and, as I mentioned before, musical numbers. Now, I'm usually pretty down on these nouveau Disney Animation Studios computer-generated movies. I mean, I feel like an old stick-in-the-mud saying it, but I really love the hand-drawn Disney movies so much more. I just think they're so much more artful than these computer-generated ones. Though I'm sure these computer-generated ones are probably faster to produce, I don't know. So I long for those things. And I was really lukewarm on Tangled. I was really lukewarm on Frozen. But I have to say, I think Moana did a really good job. And it's in no small part because of the music. One of my main complaints about Tangled and Frozen was just that they didn't feel like musicals. They felt like movies that had maybe four numbers in them. And they just didn't really have... You know, the songs were put in there out of obligation more than out of any kind of narrative choice. But thankfully, Moana is way better and it has some really great catchy tunes. And I attribute that to the involvement of Lin-Manuel Miranda, who, of course, wrote Hamilton. You've all heard of Hamilton, you know, the big Broadway musical on right now. And I feel like he really understands the structure, the way a musical should be structured with, you know, there's, like, the longing song at the beginning, and then there's the funny encounter song, and, you know, there's the reprise, there's, like, the really sad song at the cusp of the third act. The musical structure is there, and the songs are really catchy and great. I've actually found myself humming them to myself. So I think Moana is Disney Animation Studios' best, like, Disney princess musical yet, and I hope they continue down this path of improving. And I have to say, this is the first time I'll ever say it, but of the two Disney computer animated movies, the big ones that came out in 2016 being Moana and Finding Dory, I think Disney Animation Studios without Pixar actually won that battle. So I do give a big recommendation to Moana, and yeah, I think I briefly said it, but it's a lot like Aladdin. Like, Maui is very much the same kind of character as the genie, and yeah. Anyway, so a good recommendation for Moana. I'm sure it's going to win the Oscar for Best Animated Feature. Have either of you guys seen it?
No, not yet.
Well, it's a good one. Jermaine Clement.
I caught it. It's an absolute blast. I was just about to say, you didn't talk about Jermaine Clement. He was amazing in it.
Yeah, as the giant sparkly crab, he has a really terrific song, and sort of, apparently it was, that song was meant to be like a tribute to David Bowie's music. So, yeah, really good. Enjoyable. Fun for the whole family. And then the other new movie that I saw was the new M. Night Shyamalan film, Split.
Oh, where, I was hoping you had seen this.
Where James McAvoy has 24 different personalities. A premise that I can't even say without laughing. So first, guys, do you care if I spoil this movie?
Not really, no.
TK?
Spoilers for Split.
Okay, so spoilers for Split, and spoiler warning, like, skip ahead 5 minutes or so if you don't want to hear about this, because Split really is a film in the M. Night Shyamalan tradition where it has a pretty big, unexpected turn right at the end. And I'm going to spoil that, so you've been warned. Skip ahead a few minutes. So, Split. As you see in the trailer, this is a movie where Anya Taylor-Joy of The Witch, she and two other girls are kidnapped by James McAvoy, and they're, like, locked in a basement, and he has 24 different personalities. Well, he has 23 different personalities who have basically banded together to form their own, like, single-body religious cult to usher in the 24th personality, called the Beast. And these girls are all sacrifices for when the Beast arrives. Wow, man. And yes, well, first off, okay, so James McAvoy, really the main thing, the thrust of this movie is the idea of James McAvoy showing off his acting range and playing 24 different characters. So right up front, I'll say, he doesn't really. He plays more like 7 characters. We get, like, glimpses and mentions of names of these other personalities, but really we only see him play, like, 6 or 7 of them. So, you know, temper your expectations there. But in the end, I think that actually benefits the movie, because, first off, 24 personalities is just way too many for one actor to play. It's just ridiculous. And I feel like... Have you guys heard of a movie called Manifesto? It's also coming out in 2017?
I don't think so, no.
So this is a movie where Cate Blanchett, it's like an art film, and Cate Blanchett plays, I think, 12 different characters in these different vignettes. And if you look at photos of her in all these roles, she looks great. Like, she's a total chameleon. She plays, you know, like an old man who's a beggar. She plays like a frumpy Midwestern factory worker. She plays like a goth punk chick. She really looks the part, and being that it's Cate Blanchett, you know that she's a great actor. But when you watch the trailer, because it lines up so many of these different characters next to each other, the artifice is ruined. By the end of that trailer, I just saw Cate Blanchett. I didn't see any of these other characters. I just saw her in a bunch of different costumes. So, in the end, Split actually benefits from not having James McAvoy play 23 different characters, because I think that would really kill the artifice of it. Instead, he plays like 6 or 7 different personalities, and you know what? I got some complaints about this film. He is not one of them. He actually pulls it off. I completely bought it. His physicality, his voice work, just the way he held himself and behaved. On point. Like a big tip of the hat to James McAvoy for his part in Split. The girls, I mean, I like Anya Taylor-Joy, but she is not given a lot to work with here. And then the two other girls, who the actresses' names I don't know, but they are bad. Like, they are just, they are Shyamalan bad. That's the quality performance that we have come to expect out of Shyamalan movies. Anya Taylor-Joy doesn't really fall into that trap, but he does give her some pretty weird and unfortunate lines. And, as I'll mention in a moment, her character has a lot of problems with it. So, along with James McAvoy trapping these girls in a basement, he also has a therapist that he goes to, and his different personalities take control and then, like, email the therapist being like, help us, help us, and then he has to, like, go to the appointment and pretend this is what I'm talking about with his acting. He actually manages this weird trick where he plays one personality imitating a different one of his personalities. It sounds like a weird Russian nesting doll kind of performance, but he actually manages it. Anyway, he's going to this therapist, and this therapist is another, like, straight out of a Shyamalan movie character. She's actually played by the crazy old lemonade lady from The Happening.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And she believes that people with multiple personalities, when the other personalities take over, they can change the person's body. Like, they can actually alter the chemistry of someone's body. So, like, a good example of this is one of McAvoy's personalities is diabetic, and when that personality is in control of his body, he actually needs insulin. Like, so the body chemistry can actually change. And spoiler alert again, the Beast, you know, this 24th personality, when he transforms and he can, like, climb up walls and shit. So his therapist is, like, working on this paper about him to prove that people with fractured personalities, maybe they're more than human. Maybe they're actually, like, more than normal people. You see where I'm going with this? Maybe they're like superheroes.
Oh boy, I hope not.
Oh yeah. Oh yes.
Oh no.
Split is a secret sequel to Unbreakable, guys.
Oh wow.
I am not joking. In the final moments of this film, we suddenly cut to a diner, and there's a news report about McAvoy and the kidnapping of the girls and all that on a TV. And someone says, hey, this is just like that weird terrorist guy in a wheelchair. What was his name? And I shit you not, the camera pans over to Bruce Willis, and he says, his name was Mr. Glass.
Oh, cut wow.
To end credits. Split is a sequel to Unbreakable. It is the second movie in the Shyamalan cinematic universe. It is the supervillain origin story to Unbreakable's superhero origin story. And in I'll say one more thing. There are all these hints at it that you will notice. They stand out in the movie, and they once that twist is revealed, then it becomes clear what they meant. James McAvoy's character keeps visiting a train yard for some reason, because his parents were killed in, like, a train accident. So the same train bombing that created Bruce Willis's superhero created McAvoy's supervillain. What was your question, Robin?
Are they going to build up to a tie-in movie with Bruce Willis versus James McAvoy?
I do believe that is the next movie that they're going to be making.
Wow. It's kind of like 16 years ago, I would have been super stoked for an Unbreakable sequel, but so much has happened with M. Night Shyamalan since then that I don't know about this.
Some people might even say that Unbreakable was the last good movie he made. I will give him Signs. I actually quite liked Signs, but everything since Signs has been mediocre to bad. And, yeah, so here's the thing. Split has been getting some good reviews. It actually has like a 70% on Rotten Tomatoes right now. And a lot of people that whose reviews I've read, they are very focused on this ending. They were blown away by this twist. And so here's what I have to say. You've been duped. Guys, you were tricked. Because the thriller with James McAvoy and the girls in the basement, it's fine. It's not very good. It's just fine. Like, it's tense in a few bits. McAvoy's performance is good. But as a movie, like, it's like 50%. It's like 2.5 out of 5 at best. But the twist at the end, I think it works for a lot of people because they give it a positive review because they forget the movie that came before it. They become so focused on the revelation that it was an Unbreakable sequel. And I really feel like people are being blinded by this because it's like you're watching a middling movie, but then at the end, something pops up and it's like, hey, remember that better movie? Well, this movie's part of that better movie. I don't know. I really feel like people have been duped. This is a sham. This is a Shyamalan, is what it is.
Oh, cold. Jesus.
So, I mean, I don't go to the theater for Split. I really, like, save yourself the money. Wait until, like, Netflix or something. Because, on the whole, it is not great. And I said I had a problem with Anya Taylor-Joy's character. So here's the other sort of twisted message of Unsplittable. here's the sort of twisted message of it. McAvoy's character, it is revealed that he was abused, and that's part of what created his fractured personalities. It is also revealed that Anya Taylor-Joy's character was abused by her uncle, but you know what? The abuse made them both stronger. And that the movie even goes out of its way to say exactly that. It's that abuse can make people stronger. I got a problem with that message. I think that that's a really shitty message. And that is what really dragged the movie down for me more than anything else. Like, it's a passable thriller. And the twist, while ridiculous, it certainly got a lot of people. But man, that message, boo, thumbs down. So, that is Split. Oh boy, guys. I'm just trying to think. Like, I'm even trying to think of a good example. Can you think of any other example where, like, a movie blindsided you? The best one I can think of is something like The Avengers or Iron Man with the post-credit scene with Nick Fury. Something like that.
Well, it's like Iron Man was already an amazing movie in its own right. I'm trying to think. There has to be other examples of movies that weren't very good but just had, like, an amazing ending that kind of blinded you and made you think that it was a better movie than it really was. I'm sure there are other examples of that.
Well, you know what? Actually, something that I can think of that I feel is comparable to this is A Million Ways to Die in the West. A Million Ways to Die in the West. Not a very good movie. But you know what the best joke in it is? It's where he finds Doc Brown with the DeLorean in a barn.
Yes, that's true.
That's exactly it. It's just like, hey, you know what's great? This better movie, not the one you're watching. That's why people respond to that.
Yes, if Million Ways to Die in the West had ended with a Doc Brown cameo and pretended it was in the same universe as Back to the Future 3, you probably would have thought, oh my god, this was an amazing movie, and been duped. So, yeah, it's pretty much the same thing, I think, with Split.
That's how I feel about it. But like I said, I mean, credit where credit's due. James McAvoy gives a good performance, and this is way better than a lot of M. Night Shyamalan. This is probably his best movie since maybe The Village, I'd say. So, I mean, not the highest bar to clear, but that's that. Split.
Well, even The Visit, which was very, very stupid, it did get a positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes, I remember, so he's itching his way up there. He's coming into favor again somehow.
The the Shyamalanissance.
Yeah.
We're looking at a, he's just doing, he's please, doing all
please
the,
please don't say that word, please.
he's doing all the trends, the comeback trends. He's doing a Shyamalanissance and getting involved in a Shyamalanimatic cinematic universe. Boy. Anyway, that's all I've been up to. This is where the Batshit Crazy Movie Countdown would go, a segment where we count down the days until the release of movies that we think might be the most batshit crazy of any given year. And unfortunately, none of our nominees for 2017 have release dates yet, so we're not counting down, but I will reiterate the three nominees, our picks for the most potentially insane movies of 2017. I picked the movie Bright, which is directed by David Ayer, written by Max Landis, and it's a buddy cop movie where Will Smith is a cop and his partner is an orc, played by Joel Edgerton. Robin nominated Best Friends, a Tommy Wiseau, Greg Sestero movie where the two of them go on a road trip together, and Tommy Wiseau is a mortician who is smuggling gold by sewing it into the mouths of corpses, possibly based on a true story. And TK's nomination was The Killing of a Sacred Deer. This is a Yorgos Lanthimos film. Yorgos Lanthimos won our Batshit Crazy Movie Award in 2015 with The Lobster, and his first movie, Dogtooth, is also a really insane movie. So little is known about The Killing of a Sacred Deer, except for the man behind it, and he has a Batshit Crazy Movie pedigree.
And while we're on the subject of The Lobster, how shocking was it that it got an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay?
Well, that's deserved, amazing too. I'm really curious to see if it actually stands a chance. Sadly, I don't think it will win, but that was a really pleasant surprise, that nomination.
It's like, how crazy is it that one of our batshit insane movies got an Oscar nomination? I didn't know if we'd ever see that happen.
I honestly feel like Swiss Army Man was cheated, at least in the best score category, because it had such a great score. Anyway, we will talk about the nominations later this month in our show leading up to the Oscars. But yeah, The Lobster, one of our batshit crazy movies of the year, has actually garnered an Academy Award nomination, which is pretty crazy in and of itself. So now let's talk about the man who needs no introduction, Bill Murray. And, like, this is one of those cases where we're talking about someone who is so famous and so beloved. He has such a huge following, and he's like a living legend, Bill Murray. This guy, like, he has, like, mythology built up around him, things that he may or may not have done. Occasionally, strange photographs of him will surface on the internet with very little context given, showing him, like, at a college party with a bunch of cheerleaders, just the most random things. So maybe a good place to start is just to tell me, guys, I mean, do you count yourselves as fans of Bill Murray? I know I do.
Well, really, who couldn't count themselves as a Bill Murray fan? Just because he is one of a kind, and I just think the reason he has gotten so, like, iconic is just because there really isn't anyone quite like him. Just his whole acting style and public persona is just, like, so out there that it just cannot really be replicated. I mean, that's why he became such a great comedy figure, is he just has this deadpan way of doing things, of saying his dialogue and acting on screen that just makes him stand out, and he's like that in his personal life too. Like, there are just so many interesting stories about strange things he's done. Like, he's not the type of celebrity who, like, will hide behind publicists and stuff and just go through the motions. Like, he always will pop up and as part of these crazy stories. Like, it's just like life is never dull with Bill Murray. Like, you can't watch a movie or a project of his and think that he's sleepwalking through it, because he just adds his own unique touch to everything.
He really is a unique figure, it's true. TK, I mean, I think it probably goes without saying that we're all big fans of Bill Murray, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Since early days on SNL, and then watching his film career progress since we were kids, because, like, we're all 80s kids, so we all saw, like, some of his huge blockbusters as they were coming out. So, like, it's hard not to have a presence of him in our lives at some point.
when did you first come to be aware of Bill Murray?
What About Bob is the first Bill Murray movie I ever remember seeing. Yeah.
What About Bob? I feel like, for me, it was Ghostbusters. It was absolutely Ghostbusters. Robin, what about you?
Oh, absolutely, Ghostbusters.
Yeah. What About Bob? That's amazing.
Yeah, I like that movie. Richard Dreyfuss is fun to watch crazy, and Bill's kind of like, I don't want to say stoic, it's not the right word, but just like blissfully ignorant of everything going on for the whole film. It's fun.
How do you know it was What About Bob where you first found out about it? Like, did you watch Ghostbusters as a kid?
Yeah, but I think I saw What About Bob first. Like, it's the first big movie, big, quote unquote. It's the first film I ever remember seeing him in. So whether I watched it before or after Ghostbusters is, I'm sure it would have been after then, but it's, that's just what I remember him in first.
Baffling. It is baffling what you're saying. Yes, for us it was Ghostbusters. Robin, like, why, can you explain the cult of Bill Murray? It feels like, especially maybe post Lost in Translation, he just seems to have gained much more of a cult status than he had before that. I don't know. As I was looking over his career, I definitely felt like there was a dip and then an upswing where he wasn't, there was a little while where he wasn't in anything that was particularly good. And then maybe right around the time he started working with Wes Anderson, he reemerged and he started to become this guy who would, you know, put his hands over strangers' eyes and say, guess who? And then when they look at him, he'd go, nobody's ever going to believe this happened. Or, you know, he'll walk over and steal people's French fries. It really seemed to be much more of a later career development. I don't know. What do you think? How do you explain the cult of Bill Murray?
Yeah, it's weird because I don't remember hearing stories about like that during like the 80s and 90s, but it seemed to happen like around the time like he got a resurrection because of Lost in Translation and Wes Anderson and just the stories about how he does business. Like, he won't sign contracts. He doesn't have an agent. And I read a story about how if you want him to be in your movie, you leave a message on this 1-800 number he leaves. And it's not even, and apparently he doesn't even have a voicemail. It's just a beep. And you just like leave a message for him. And you will not know apparently until like he shows up on set if he's going to agree to do your movie. He's just got such a quirky way where it's like he never does anything standard. And I know there were stories about how like he wouldn't sign any contracts for like Wes Anderson movies, and like the producers in the studio would be paranoid saying, well, how do you know he's going to show up? And they're like, well, if Bill says he'll show up, he'll show up. And that's just kind of the way he functions, where it's like he does everything differently than the average Hollywood star. And I think people find that endearing. And also like these stories about how he'll just approach strangers in public and like pull pranks on them and stuff, or just show up at people's parties. People kind of like the fact that he doesn't think he's above like regular folks, that he'll just hang out with them on a whim and stuff. I don't know where this came from, but I think it's made him such a even more beloved iconic figure in like the past decade.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is like, is this an act? What is going on here? Because Bill Murray is such a unique character, the more I read up on him and the more I studied his career in anticipation of this podcast, the more I realized that he's also this enigma where, like, is he actually a sad clown, or is he actually all that wacky? Which character of the ones that he's played is the most like the real Bill Murray? Is this like a, almost like an Andy Kaufman situation where he puts on so many different public personas that nobody really knows what's an act and what's real? I don't know, TK, do you have any thoughts on that?
I just think he's such an interesting character because, like, you see how he was acting in the 70s and 80s with SNL stuff, and then you see him, like, turn into this, I don't want to say turn into, but, like, become this almost reclusive character. And, like, yeah, sure, he's everywhere, but, like, you wouldn't hear anything about him in the news or anything like that at all until he was starring in a film where he'd show up on Letterman or something like that. And he just tends to... there's this weird mythos of him like popping in, and I think that that's something that's just kind of evolved over time. Like, he does, like Robin was just saying, he doesn't sign contracts, he just shows up. And I think that's such a interesting mythos. It's like, can you think of another actor that would do anything like that or be let away?
Well, Andy Kaufman is the one that came to mind for me, and I really do feel like there are a lot of similarities in these two gentlemen. They like to sort of provoke and see if they can push the boundaries of what is acceptable. And in the case of Andy Kaufman, he was sort of pushing the boundaries of good taste to see what he could get away with. With Bill Murray, it's like, you know, an actor who doesn't want to sign a contract. He's not going to, he doesn't even give you his real phone number. There's no voice, you know, you could just be talking at nobody for all you know. It's things like that where I feel like those are the similarities between maybe Bill Murray and Andy Kaufman, but you didn't really answer my question. Do you think this is all an act? Is he just doing this to create his own legend? Do you think he's really like that?
I think part of him is like that. I think part of him has just embraced the urban legend status and just does little things to kind of reminisce with you. Like a sports team won a big championship that he was at, and he kind of wandered into the press room and just started answering questions. And I think that that's something he did thinking that's going to make it seem weird. And I think that that's something he just kind of runs with.
So part of it is definitely like a deliberate, he's not just a weird eccentric. He is like deliberately putting on a show.
Yeah, but to an extent, I think what he did is like he wanted to stay kind of reclusive, and he had that no agent phone number thing, and that just kind of spun stories. And he thought, well, if the opportunity,
he didn't stop them, he kind of nurtured them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not going to stop them, and if I can, I'm going to kick them up a little.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's almost
because
like
that's. That is the type of person I think Bill Murray is.
Maybe a good comparison would be someone like Nicolas Cage or Werner Herzog, where the public helps build this sort of outward persona, and then they don't stop it. They're like, okay, this is what people expect me to be, so I'm going to be like that. Bill Murray and Werner Herzog. Why haven't they worked together? Anyway.
Oh, he's just going to show up when Werner Herzog is filming at a volcano or something, and Bill Murray's just going to stop by and ask if he can be in his movie.
Oh, my God. He'll climb out of the volcano for all we know.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about our favorite Bill Murray performances. And before we even get into our top three lists, we should mention the movies that are in our pantheon that are all great Bill Murray performances that we are not allowed to put on our lists. And they are Ghostbusters, Ed Wood, and Rushmore. Do you guys want to say just a few words on any or all of those performances? Maybe explain why these are in our pantheon?
Well, Ghostbusters would be my number one, obviously, if we were allowed to use it, just because it is his most iconic performance, and it's the movie that introduced me to him, and he pretty much makes the movie just with his weird deadpan wise guy attitude, so that's what made me a fan right from the outset. And Ed Wood is another one, like, it's not in my pantheon, but I know it's in yours, but it's just how random it is, because it's kind of a small supporting role, but the character is just so bizarre that it just seems like the kind of thing Bill Murray would embrace and love to do, even though it's not a starring role.
Yeah, and another reason that Ed Wood is in my pantheon is because it just kept coming up on this podcast. Like, for all that we may not think of it collectively as being like one of our all-time favorite movies, I'm pretty sure it was among our favorite biopics, our favorite Johnny Depp performances, our favorite Tim Burton movies. We really came back to Ed Wood again and again, and even though Ed Wood is very much Johnny Depp's movie, Bill Murray is just absolutely hilarious in it, in that supporting role, and he gets so many great memorable lines. Like, they're about to baptize him. You know, do you renounce Satan? Sure. And they dunk him. Yeah, really great. And TK, Rushmore is in your pantheon, and I know you're a big fan of Wes Anderson movies, but why Rushmore above all others?
Because I think it's, say what you will about some other films, which I'll talk about a bit later, I imagine. Like, I know that you guys are, you particularly go, I know you really like The Royal Tenenbaums. I think that's your favorite Anderson film, or Moonrise, hang on, or Grand Budapest, I think. One of the two.
I mean, it's hard to pick now. Back when we talked about Wes Anderson and, like, devoted an episode to him, I think it was before one or two of those movies had come out. These days, I'd probably list The Grand Budapest Hotel as my favorite Wes Anderson movie, but I also do like The Royal Tenenbaums.
It's, I think that Murray has such an interesting turn for Murray, because this is when he started to take, because you look at his filmography beforehand, it's a lot of kind of like, I don't want to say silly, it's not the right word, but he did like a lot of comedy films. And this was his first, not his first step into dramatic acting, but I think it was his first big step into a dramatic acting role. And I think he did it in such a really interesting way, and kind of alternatively kind of showing that he had that depth to a wider audience. And that's why it's so interesting. And I'm sorry, I love the character of Harold Bloom so much. He's so ridiculous in the whole movie. But just, I don't know, he has this way to convey like his care and emotion, and it's such a, no one else can play Harold Bloom except Bill Murray.
Well, I have to say that while Rushmore, I mean, I love Rushmore, don't get me wrong. I think it's definitely one of Wes Anderson's better movies for sure, if not my favorite. But I will say this, even if Rushmore is not my favorite Wes Anderson movie, it is the tour de force performance from Bill Murray in all of Wes Anderson movies, even more so than I think The Life Aquatic. I think Rushmore is the movie that is the perfect sort of Wes Anderson-Bill Murray collaboration. So let's get into our lists. You know, those are our gold standard Bill Murray movies. Outside of those, what are our top three Bill Murray films? TK, what's your number three?
I went through this period in university where I would take actors and watch a bunch of their filmography all at once. I did it with like John Cusack and like Jim Carrey, and I would watch all the films they made. And I went through this period where I did a whole bunch of Bill Murray films, and one of the first ones I got a hold of, because I was really wanted to see it, it was actually my first Jim Jarmusch movie, and that's Broken Flowers, where Murray plays this reclusive millionaire who finds out he may have a son, so he starts to go visit past girlfriends and try to reconnect with them. And there's something, anyone who listens to the podcast know I kind of like the quiet indie stuff, and like this was a really good example of that. I just thought Bill's acting, while it was subdued, was really nuanced, and it was something that, until this point, I don't think I'd seen in such a startling in-front effect. And I just think it's a tour de force of him acting, and I think that it's kind of like this weird, weird, beautiful film all at once. The last 5 minutes drive me absolutely crazy, but it's just such a delightful kind of watch. Have either of you guys seen this?
I have not seen Broken Flowers, and you said the last 5 minutes drive you crazy, like in a bad way?
Yeah, there's like two things that happen that just kind of like, so he spends the entire film not looking for, but wanting confirmation he has a son. And then he finds this kid who's hitchhiking and thinks that he's his son, and it just gets very odd in the last like 5 minutes. It's just really weird, and it kind of throws me off the whole thing. But he goes through the whole film really well. It's really, really, it's almost haunting, actually, in a weird way. But it's a beautiful, beautiful acting stretch for him.
Robin, have you seen Broken Flowers?
I have, actually. I'm not the biggest fan of it. I'm really not a big fan of Jim Jarmusch in general. I do think it's a kind of a meandering film overall, but it is a pretty good Bill Murray performance, kind of like very subdued. Like, it only came out a few years after Lost in Translation, so this was him doing more of his dramatic roles with kind of a comedic bent to them and stuff. I kind of like how his character's name is like Don Johnson for whatever reason. I guess he's kind of, because he's known as like a Don Juan, and most of his performances are kind of like reaction shots, I seem to remember. I know he goes to visit one of his former lovers, and the girl's like teenage daughter just kind of walks out naked in front of them for like no reason, and he just has this like deadpan look on his face, but he doesn't really say anything, which is pretty funny. So not a favorite of mine, but it does kind of show his range, that if he wants to do dramatic roles, that he's actually like really good at them.
I'll probably get to this one eventually because I do, in general, like Jim Jarmusch, but I do find that Jim Jarmusch's films are quite hit and miss, and I know Broken Flowers did not get amazing reviews when it was released, so I wouldn't say I'm rushing out to see it, but I'm sure I will because I'm slowly working my way through Jarmusch's filmography. Robin, what's your number three?
Well, my number three, it's just a cameo, but I had to put it on the list because I firmly believe this is probably the best use of a cameo in cinematic history, and that's his role in Zombieland, which is just so brilliant on so many levels. I remember seeing this in the theater on opening night, and I had no idea that Bill Murray was going to be in it, and I just love the way they set it up where the characters go to Hollywood and they go into this giant mansion which belongs to a celebrity, but you don't know who it's going to be. They kind of hold it off in a while until you see this very bizarre portrait of Bill Murray sitting out there in the living room, and then he shows up, like, and everyone thinks he's a zombie, and then, but it turns out he's only pretending, and it's a build up to like the most obvious gag ever, where it's going to be like, oh, Jesse Eisenberg's going to shoot him because he thinks he's a real zombie when he's pretending, and it does happen, but every time I saw it in the theater, the audience still like gasped and laughed hysterically about it, and it just he throws his, of course, his old weird Bill Murray touch, like where they ask him, like, do you have any regrets, and he says Garfield maybe, and then he just lets out like these long, what he thinks are final breaths, but he doesn't die, he just does it over and over again, and it's just this kind of awkward silence till he finally dies. And I'd love to know the story about how they got Bill Murray to do this role, if this was one of these things where he just kind of showed up on set and feel like, hey, I'll play your zombie in the movie for you and stuff. But it's just such a great usage of a cameo, and it plays to like his strengths, and it's I guess the best way to say it, he's playing Bill Murray in a very Bill Murray-ish type of fashion where it's just so out of left field and so bizarre that it just seems to fit so well. And every time I saw it in the theater, all the scenes with them just played off so well, and I can't think of a better example of a movie using a big star in a cameo like any better than this one. So even though it's such a small role, it is just handled so brilliantly. That's why I had to put it on my top three.
A small role, and he's playing himself too. Like it, I honestly would have put Zombieland on my list, but I figured somebody was going to put it there anyway because it really is just a terrific little Bill Murray appearance that even though he's like in zombie makeup and he's playing sort of this cartoonish version of himself, a character of himself, it's still not an over the top performance except for like a few moments. Like he's still just playing that deadpan Bill Murray persona that we were talking about. And it works incredibly well, and it is really funny. There's a great montage where it's sort of like, you know, how do you entertain yourself during the zombie apocalypse with Bill Murray? And they dress up like Ghostbusters and run around the mansion, and they smoke a giant hookah pipe, and, you know, Woody Harrelson dries his eyes with money. It is absolutely hilarious. And I do know the story of that cameo. And Bill Murray was not actually the first person they offered it to. According to IMDb, they offered it to Patrick Swayze first.
Okay.
Which
interesting.
Is kind of interesting, but around the same time, Swayze had his cancer diagnosis. So they just fell on Bill Murray instead. I also just want to note before I pass it over to TK for his thoughts on Zombieland, that Zombieland is like, it's a movie that really, it almost shouldn't work because it's so obviously influenced by Shaun of the Dead, and it was made during that like zombie movie craze of those few years before everybody got kind of burnt out on zombies. But somehow, even just doing like another comedy in the style of Shaun of the Dead with zombies, it really worked. They've been teasing us with Zombieland 2 for so long. I kind of feel like the moment has probably passed, but just based on the strength of this movie and that Bill Murray cameo, I will definitely see the sequel. TK, Zombieland, what do you think?
That's a killer cameo. I love whenever they're asking him, like, what have you been doing with your time? Shuffle with the zombies. Play a lot of golf. that's exactly
amazing.
What Bill Murray would do with his time. That is the greatest, easily one of the greatest cameos in cinema history, as far as I'm concerned. It's fantastic.
So my number three, I wanted to pick something a little more obscure, maybe something that was not quite as obvious and from early in Bill Murray's acting career. So I've chosen a movie called Where the Buffalo Roam. Now,
I knew it! I knew this would be on your list.
Of course, of course. I am an unabashed fan of the work of Hunter S. Thompson. I love the movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I love so much of Thompson's writing, the novel Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Hell's Angels, On the Campaign Trail, etc., etc., etc. And because, you know, Hunter Thompson is sort of like a perfect pairing with Bill Murray, because he is another person who was a living legend, like a legend in their own time, and built up this weird kind of persona mythology around them, and also became a lot weirder as they got older. And apparently, Bill Murray, this was around the time that he was on SNL, and he was cast in this role, and so he went and he hung out with Hunter Thompson on Thompson's ranch to get into character, something that Johnny Depp would later do when he was going to play Hunter Thompson in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And both of these actors, upon spending time with Hunter Thompson, then started to take on a lot of Thompson's less desirable habits. Like, apparently, when Bill Murray returned to SNL, he started, like, peeing in potted plants around the studio and, you know, smoking all the time and likely doing loads of drugs and drinking all the time as well. And so apparently the Hunter Thompson boot camp had quite the effect on Bill Murray, and something that Bill Murray, at least, you know, rumor has it, Bill Murray said this to Johnny Depp before they shot Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He said, you know, be careful hanging out with Hunter S. Thompson, because he is such a strong personality that he'll, like, burn himself into your mind and you'll never get him out again. There will always be a little bit of Hunter S. Thompson in you after you spend any significant amount of time emulating him. So, Where the Buffalo Roam is, like, loosely based on the writings of Hunter Thompson. It's not, you know, based, quote-unquote, based on a true story. It's not really based on any of Thompson's specific books. And it's almost like, Thompson was never really happy with the way Gary Trudeau portrayed him in the comic strip Doonesbury. And I've read that Thompson also didn't quite like the depiction of him in Where the Buffalo Roam. He was like, it's just like, it's a cartoon, you know, this is like comic book stuff. This isn't at all the reality. It's played up for laughs. You know, this is way more over the top than Hunter Thompson actually is. I mean, I find that hard to believe, but this is what Thompson has said. I think it's just like a perfect little curiosity piece. Bill Murray doing his version of Hunter Thompson is really interesting to see, and he's also really funny. And Peter Boyle, the late Peter Boyle, plays Oscar Zeta Acosta, who is the Dr. Gonzo character from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and who was a friend of Hunter Thompson's. And it's also interesting just to see, like, that interpretation with that actor in that role. So I wouldn't give this a huge recommendation to everybody, but if you like Hunter S. Thompson and you like Bill Murray as well, you should check out Where the Buffalo Roam. It's a really interesting little curiosity that is often overlooked, but a great performance from Bill Murray, and I would recommend it to fans of Hunter Thompson. Have either of you guys seen this?
I never actually have. It's funny, I've read about how when it was originally released, it was critically panned and was kind of a major bomb. Probably because, like, people really wouldn't have known how to respond to a Hunter S. Thompson movie back then, because they had probably never made anything like it. But I know it's built up kind of a cult reputation over the years. But I did kind of wonder if it would be on your list, because you love everything all Hunter S. Thompson.
And it's also just because it's one of the lesser known Bill Murray movies that I feel could deserve a little more exposure. That's why it's my number three. Like, I have no delusions that this is a great movie, and certainly Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is the superior Hunter Thompson escapades film, but it is a really neat performance by Bill Murray. And one thing that Where the Buffalo Roam has that really no other Hunter Thompson property, book, or movie has is a fictionalized encounter where Hunter runs into Richard Nixon in a men's room and like pontificates at him. And if you're a fan of Hunter Thompson, it is pretty fun to see that idea realized, because he famously had like this journalistic outrage towards Nixon all through Nixon's career. So Where the Buffalo Roam is my number three. TK, what is your number two?
Oh, my number two. Ah, where's my list? There it is. I had to throw a Wes Anderson movie on here, and because I couldn't pick Rushmore, and I feel that Tenenbaums is a little underutilized, I decided to go with The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, because this is a film that I watched for the first time and didn't really enjoy it. And every time I've watched it since, it's gotten better and better and better for me. And I think it's all, a lot of it is again, like my like for him in Broken Flowers, it's a little nuanced, and he doesn't play very emotional. He does have some killer lines though, about when he's trying to teach his quote unquote son, played by Owen Wilson, how to fist fight someone. No, you don't just come up to someone and say you're going to hit them. You just hit them. and him dancing slowly to the music that they've piped into the scuba suits. It's just, please don't point that gun at him. He's an unpaid intern. Like, there's so much about this film I really, really enjoy. And 95% of it is Bill Murray's performance as Zissou.
Now, Robin, of the three of us, you are the least fan. Like, I believe to recap your opinion on Wes Anderson movies is that they're fine, but you're not a huge fan the way maybe TK and I are, right?
Yeah, that's correct, because I all of the faults in the movie have nothing to do with Bill Murray, I think, because I always think he does like a solid role. I think a lot of my faults just come from the writing and the lack of like narrative and story to most of his films.
And how do you feel about The Life Aquatic within the oeuvre of Wes Anderson?
I haven't seen it since it originally came out. I didn't dislike it or anything, but like it was like a lot of Wes Anderson movies at the time. There were parts of it I thought were really clever and funny, but there were other parts of it that just kind of went over my head, where I just didn't really understand like the joke or something, or really, and I felt kind of like the narrative was weak, and it would just kind of stumble from like one random incident to the other. It's a decent enough movie, but it's not one that I have revisited since it happened.
Yeah, The Life Aquatic, I mean, it is the other obvious choice if we're talking strictly about Bill Murray, because it's a role that was clearly tailor-made for Bill Murray by Wes Anderson, and sure enough, he's great in it. This sort of, it's Bill Murray does Jacques Cousteau. It is really sort of fun and charming and light. I definitely find, like, there's some sad and depressing moments occasionally in The Life Aquatic, but it's definitely one of the lightest Wes Anderson films, like very easily digestible story, and a really good soundtrack to all these covers, these acoustic guitar covers of David Bowie, again, late David Bowie's music. But overall, within the oeuvre of Wes Anderson, Life Aquatic ranks pretty low on my list. That being said, my number two, I just wrote Wes Anderson, because I maybe it's cheating, but I have yet to see a Wes Anderson film that featured Bill Murray where I did not like Bill Murray in it. Every time he pops up, it's really fun. Even in the Darjeeling Limited, where he has no lines, he is in one scene, he's in the opening scene. Even that little bit of Bill Murray right at the beginning, he is so terrific. He doesn't even say a single word. He's just this businessman, and he's rushing to the train station. He's trying to get to his train, and then he's running down the platform as the train is pulling away, and will Bill Murray make it? And then he's overtaken by Adrian Brody, who does make it, and they leave Bill Murray in the dust. You know, even just a little thing like that, he's so well used every time Wes Anderson uses him. So I just put down Wes Anderson, and The Life Aquatic is definitely included in that. Maybe that's a cheat. Robin, do you have any thoughts on just Bill Murray within the works of Wes Anderson?
Yes, I pretty much agree with you that even if I'm not a fan of the films himself, I really like his performances in there, and I think they kind of helped resurrect his career, because just looking at his filmography and you see some of the stupid comedies he was making like before Rushmore, and this one kind of put him in a new light that kind of just showed his range, that he wasn't just like this goofy comedian. Like, even though I'm not a big fan of Rushmore, I really like his performance in that, and I think he does an outstanding job in all the films, and I think him and Wes Anderson were made for each other. So it's like, whatever misgivings I have with Anderson's work, it has nothing to do with Bill Murray. I think he's always enjoyable to watch in those films.
Yeah, it should be said, before Bill Murray started working with Wes Anderson, he made Space Jam and The Man Who Knew Too Little back-to-back.
And Larger Than Life, the elephant movie.
Oh my god, that's right. Yeah, not great. TK, you and I totally, like, faked you out by quibbling with you about, like, oh, what are the best and the worst Wes Anderson films? And then I was like, haha, I just picked Wes Anderson. Do you have any thoughts on Bill Murray in all of Wes Anderson's work?
I didn't like him as much in Moonrise Kingdom for some reason. Like, he does, wow. Oh my gosh, whenever he catches them on the beach, it's amazing. But I don't know, I just found
that's
him
the one
part
where
of...
he gets drunk and he's like, I'm going to go chop down a tree.
I know, but like, can you think of any other moments besides that and when he takes the tent off them?
I mean, one moment that immediately sprung to mind when we were talking about, is this all an act, is from the behind-the-scenes featurette where he gives you a tour of the set and he's drunk on red wine and in costume.
Oh, man, yeah, that was fantastic.
That's the thing. I really never think he's poorly used in Wes Anderson films.
No, not at all. I actually really like him as Riley St. Clair in Royal Tannenbaums. That's amazing. Just fantastic stuff. No, he's
the Badger
Wes
and Fantastic
Anderson,
Mr. Fox.
The voice work is. Are you cussing with me? The voice work is fantastic in that. But it's Anderson either knows how to, like, perfectly utilize him, or he just lets him do whatever he needs to do. And either scenario works out very well for me. So, I think maybe he just does that all the time.
He's like, we just trust Bill Murray. Just go do your thing, Bill.
I can get that. I can get behind that.
Robin, what's your number two?
Well, my number two was actually one of my earliest columns of Robin's underrated gems, and I think it's probably the most underrated film of Bill Murray's career, and that's Quick Change. And if I recall correctly, I think McGill had not even heard of this film until I wrote a column on it, which was pretty surprising, but that kind of shows how this one has flown under the radar. And it's also notable because it's actually the only directorial thing he's ever done. He co-directed it with another guy named Howard Franklin, and is the only time Murray has ever done it in his career. But it has such a cool premise because it starts out with Bill Murray dressed as a sad clown pulling off a bank robbery, this elaborate one where it turns out that he and Gina Davis and Randy Quaid will disguise themselves as hostages and then sneak out of the bank and escape with the money because no one has figured out that he's the clown. But that's just like the first act of the movie. The core of the movie is just their adventures trying to get from Manhattan to the airport because they run into a whole bunch of transportation problems and keep crossing like all these wacky characters in New York where like everything goes wrong. And what's kind of funny is that Bill Murray kind of plays the straight man in this. Like, he's almost like the most normal character in the movie because he just crossed paths with so many different characters who are like so bizarre that a lot of the humor just comes from Murray's like deadpan reaction to like the worst night ever. It's quite hilarious, and it's kind of neat to see like a lot of before they were stars moments in this because you see a lot of famous actors like Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub just popping up in these small roles. I know Stanley Tucci plays like this mobster henchman, and Tony Shalhoub plays like this cab driver who doesn't understand English and is like running red lights and stuff. And there's like this great suspenseful scene where they want to board the bus and they get the most anal retentive bus driver ever who will not accept anything but exact change. So like he has a time limit where Bill Murray has to get exact change from the supermarket in like 3 minutes because the bus driver is so strict that he will drive off without them and stuff. And of course the cops and the mobsters are going to try to catch him before he gets his exact change. Like really, really clever scenes. It's one of the best like New York movies ever that kind of shows like the wackiness of New York. And it kind of flew on the radar. It's not one of the most well-known comedies of his career, but I think it's one of the better ones and just kind of shows how would you make a movie where Bill Murray is a wacky comedy where Bill Murray is the most normal character. It's kind of goes against the grain, but very funny and very, very clever. And I've always encouraged everyone to check this out because it is definitely not one of his more well-known films.
TK, have you seen it? Quick Change?
No, I haven't. And it was one of those ones, like, I knew it was going to be on Robin's list because we have talked about it before in the past, but I haven't even caught up on it. I think I've seen the trailer and that's about it, but it looks good. And at some point, I'm sure I'll catch up to it. I'm just not there yet.
It is a really enjoyable movie. And, Robin, I hadn't heard about it before you wrote that column. And I believe I even borrowed your copy to watch it. And, it is a really fun little madcap comedy movie, and like you said, it's a really good New York movie. It is definitely one of those films that's like at once making fun of and a love letter to New York City. I feel like it's almost like an extended version of a Scooby-Doo chase scene, one of those ones where they're, you know, going in and out of doors. Like, it really is like... The story is just this series of encounters that, as Murray and company try to escape the city. It's really good, but I think I know why it flew under the radar. It's because it was right in the middle of a streak that Bill Murray was on, where all these movies that he was in were so noteworthy or so good that they kind of just outshine Quick Change. Because Quick Change is good, but... It's not as good as something like What About Bob or Groundhog Day or Scrooged or, you know, Ghostbusters a few years prior. And I feel like that's probably why it got lost in the mix. Like, also comparable is shortly after Ghostbusters, he was in The Razor's Edge. Does anybody talk about that anymore? I had never heard of that movie. So that I feel like that's probably the case here. But yeah, Quick Change is a great one for people to check out because not many people know about it. So let's see, my number two was all of Wes Anderson, which means, TK, it's your number one.
Oh, man, already? My number one is whenever I started watching all of a bunch of Murray's films, and this was the first one I watched and the one that hit me most, and that's Lost in Translation. I think he's unbelievable in this. It's the chemistry between him and Scarlett Johansson is really interesting, and even just his pure disinterest in just being in Tokyo and just dealing with the culture shock is just unbelievably fascinating to watch. I've seen this movie probably five times, and I always find something kind of new in his performance that kind of blows me away. And I enjoy Sofia Coppola's directing, and I think that she knew how to utilize him well, and it's fascinating. I really get a big kick out of this film, and I think it's a good pinnacle for his acting. I think this is his best acted role. I really do. I think Bob Harris is perfectly Bill Murray, and nothing's going to ever change that, I don't think. But I have a lot of love for this film, and I think that it's the greatest thing he's done. I really do. Say what you will about Ghostbusters, I think Lost in Translation is him.
Really? You rank it even higher than Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, for relaxing times, make it Santori times. Robin,
it feels like he said a lot more than that.
Robin, what did you think of Lost in Translation?
Well, I think it's a great Bill Murray performance, but I happen to think it's one of the most overrated films of this century. Just, I've never been a fan of this, and it's got nothing to do with Bill Murray. I think he's outstanding at playing like a very lonely guy who's trapped in like a world that he just cannot relate to. But I just think the film is really lacking in narrative thrust because it doesn't have much of a story. It just kind of shows his interactions with Scarlett Johansson, and that carries it well up to a point, but it just kind of wore on me after a while, where it's kind of like, okay, I really want something to happen now. Like, it just started to drag for me and stuff. So, and it was kind of a shame. Like, I think he probably did deserve to win Best Actor that year, but I was just not a fan of the film itself. Like, I haven't really revisited it since it was released in 2003, but I remember being like hugely disappointed by it. It's just not a film that really worked for me.
So I come down right in between you guys on Lost in Translation. I do agree, Robin. I think Lost in Translation is overrated. But I also get it. I've watched it a few times, and every time, like, it does stir emotion in me. And it really makes me... I think that it is a film about a very specific kind of experience... You know, feeling like a stranger in a place that's very foreign to you and connecting with someone else who, over the smallest connection, you know, because you're both there and you're both American, something like, you're staying in the same hotel. That, I have had that happen to me before when I've gone traveling. And it does give you, you know, also the idea of like going someplace and making a friend, and then when the two of you part, knowing you'll probably never see them again. Like, there's a real bittersweetness to that particular emotion, and I think that is what Lost in Translation nails. And it is, in large part, because of Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. The movie itself, besides that, like, it's not one that I come back to again and again. I think it is really good. I don't think it is as great as a lot of people think it is. And one more note, though, is something I find fascinating about the film is it is half of this, I don't even know what to call it. It's like these two cinematic poems to long distance relationships. Lost in Translation and the Spike Jonze movie Her. Spike Jonze and Sofia Coppola were a couple, and because they were a couple, they had to spend a lot of time apart, you know, being filmmakers and for work. And a lot of this is conjecture. Nobody really knows if it's 100% confirmed. I know Spike Jonze has talked a little bit about this, but basically the idea is that Lost in Translation is what Sofia Coppola's side of her relationship to Spike Jonze looked like when they were like in a long distance relationship. And Her, the movie Her, is the Spike Jonze side of that same kind of story. Because both of them have, you know, that sense of longing, and Her certainly, with Scarlett Johansson at the center of it too. It's Scarlett Johansson in both movies in that Sofia Coppola role. Anyway, so apparently these two films are something of a piece, and whether or not you fully buy this theory, it is out there, and it's one that I find fascinating. And for me, that's almost the more fascinating thing about Lost in Translation than the substance of the movie itself. I don't know, had you guys heard about that?
Oh, no, that's the first time I've heard that story.
TK, had you heard about that one?
No, not even a little. That's fascinating.
Does that rework how you think of Lost in Translation? Can you sort of see that in there?
Yeah, vaguely. I'd have to sit with it a bit more, but it's we'll talk about it later. Let me think on that.
Yeah. Anyway, I find that really interesting about Lost in Translation, and it's certainly not a bad movie, and a great performance from Bill Murray, surely. Robin, what is your number one?
Well, we haven't talked about it yet, so I figured I would put it as number one on my list, and it fits with the theme of our podcast today, and that's Groundhog Day, of course, since we were recording this on Groundhog Day, and this is definitely, like, just a fascinating performance by Bill Murray. Like, it's interesting to look back, because I remember when Groundhog Day came out in 1993, and it did well at the box office. It got good reviews, but it just kind of faded into memory. But as the years have gone on, people now kind of rank it as one of the greatest comedies of all time. Like, for whatever reason, his reputation has grown so much over the years that it's looked upon as a classic, and it's probably because it has such a great premise. Like, what if you had to relive the same day over and over again and had to correct your mistakes until you got caught out of this time loop? And, it's just such a perfect vehicle for Murray because, like, at the beginning of the movie, he plays like his typical character, a guy who's kind of like this wise ass, this arrogant jerk and stuff, like your typical, like, Bill Murray character. But as the movie goes on, he has to correct himself, like, he has to relive the day and, like, go through the same repetition, like, over and over again until he finally becomes a better person and becomes a good enough person that he breaks away from this time loop. And it's got a lot of depth to it, just the more and more you watch it. And you can see that it also kind of becomes a tragedy as well. Like, it gets to the point where he wants to commit suicide several times, but it still doesn't work, and he has to, like, wake up over and over again. And it's quite interesting. What I find fascinating about this is that as you're watching it, you kind of realize that Bill Murray might not have learned the lesson from it about how to become a better person, because I know the story about how it was directed by Harold Ramis, and apparently they got along so badly during filming that they didn't speak for like several years, like for only a decade and stuff. So here we have a movie where you have to learn to become a better person, yet Bill Murray, the experience of filming it actually fractured a friendship with one of his best friends for a while. I just kind of find that fascinating, and it adds like a lot of poignancy to this, especially since Harold Ramis has since died. But yeah, it's one of those comedies that just gets better with age, because I think a lot of people can identify with the premise, like what would I do if I had a second chance and had to correct myself over and over again. And I think Bill Murray is just, you watch it, you just can't visualize like anybody else in the role, just because it suits him so well, just to see him kind of evolve as the movie goes along. And that's why it's looked upon as one of his all-time classics.
Well, Groundhog Day is also my number one movie, and an appropriate little turn of events, because it's, you know, repetition. Groundhog Day is all about repeating the same thing over and over. So I, too, will say the best Bill Murray performance outside of our Pantheon films is Groundhog Day. And this is another movie, not only is it really tightly written, really well done, like I can totally see why people think of this as a classic comedy. It's one of those cases, almost like Star Wars, where you read about what was originally supposed to happen, and you think, my God, like they made some smart choices to take stuff out of this. They really dodged a bullet. I know in the original draft of Groundhog Day, we were supposed to find out that the time loop was the result of a curse put on Bill Murray by a vengeful ex-girlfriend, apparently. Things like that, you know, like it is really kind of amazing how well edited and well crafted the movie ended up being. And not only is it a good comedy and a sweet romance and a great performance from Bill Murray, but it also features the iconic role of Stephen Tobolowsky, actor that we all really like. We've all met him in person, and I really love the Tobolowsky Files podcast that he does. And he is hilarious as Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, and I highly recommend you check out his podcast episodes where he talks about his experience working on Groundhog Day, because you get all the great Bill Murray insight. Apparently, he and Bill Murray bought donuts for all the extras one day and like went around handing them out together. Just funny little things like that. But I believe he also does touch upon the weird rivalry that had been brewing between Murray and Ramis. TK, what do you think of Groundhog Day?
Oh, I'm a big fan of the film. It's I knew it was going to show up on the list because of the day of recording, obviously, and the fact that it is one of Bill's greatest roles, so I decided to keep it off my list, concentrate on my small indie stuff, and I knew it would show up somewhere. But he's just so much fun to watch this, especially the montages. Like, the suicide montage, while sad, is still pretty goddamn funny. Him walking in front of the bus is hysterical. But I like the movie's message. The slow self-actualization, I think, is really, really fun. But it's just, he's great in it. The diner scene is the best one, where
he reads everybody, I'm a god. Yeah, that's really great.
And of course, this movie also gets bonus points for featuring Bill Murray giving WrestleMania tickets to a young Michael Shannon.
That's right, yeah, Michael Shannon in that tiny little role. Yeah, terrific. Groundhog Day is absolutely a Bill Murray classic. And I love that the Royal Cinema here in Toronto have been playing Groundhog Day all day long. You just have to go and buy one ticket, and you can stay for all the screenings of Groundhog Day. I think that is a pretty terrific little movie gimmick for a theater to put on. So surely we all have some honorable mentions. TK, do you have any honorable mentions for Bill Murray performances?
Yeah, do I ever. I have a whole lot, and I feel that I'm going to get ahead of them for you guys, so just bear with me a second. Sorry, I have my list and now my desk. You can't talk about Bill Murray without talking about Caddyshack. That ad-lib line, which is like one of the AFI's funniest lines of all time. It's a Cinderella story. He's funny. And just the whole back and forth with the groundhog is perfect. It's so good. Okay, I like him in Kingpin because he's so gloriously over the top, and it just works within the confines of that film. He's so funny.
He is great, and I particularly love during the like big bowling competition at the end how his comb over is just getting like wilder and wilder and sticking out all ridiculous. Yeah, that's a Kingpin is like a runner up for my list because I think Murray is just hilarious in it.
Oh yeah, he makes the whole thing. And honestly, we've talked about a lot of the other films that I had on my list. Like all the Wes Anderson stuff we chatted about, and gosh, I don't know what else to say from here.
Robin,
how about you guys?
Do you have any others that haven't been mentioned?
Scrooged, of course. I make sure to watch that like every Christmas. It's one of his great, like having him cast as like Ebenezer Scrooge, like a modern day, I think was just brilliant casting. And I know the movie was critically panned when it originally came out, but I think it's like been reinvigorated as like a Christmas classic, and I love watching him in that. I also love his role in Tootsie. Like, a lot of people forget he's even in that because it's a small supporting role, but he plays Dustin Hoffman's roommate, and I think he gets some of the biggest laughs of the movie just because of his like shocked reaction to seeing like Dustin Hoffman like pretend to be a woman and becoming famous, and just his deadpan delivery of lines saying that, "You do realize you're going to go to hell for this, don't you?" I think that's one of his more underrated performances. I also love his random supporting role in the movie Wild Things, where he just completely steals the movie as like this sleazy like lawyer and stuff. He's only in the movie like a couple scenes, but I remember seeing that movie in the theater when it originally came out, and the audience just roared at like every scene he was in. Like he just kind of sticks out in like this like sleazy erotic thriller just doing this comedic relief scene, but I think he's absolutely hilarious in it. And yeah, that's a you pretty much listed like all my others, but those are a couple of the ones that I think are kind of underrated performances of his.
Well, there are a couple that we still haven't mentioned that I feel require shout-outs. It's just a walk-on role, but Little Shop of Horrors, I really like him as the masochistic dental patient. I mean, that's a sort of a wacky little musical, and Steve Martin is hilarious as the sadistic, like a greaser dentist with a motorcycle. And one of the better scenes, I think, in Little Shop of Horrors is where a masochistic patient played by Bill Murray comes in and completely flummoxes Steve Martin's dentist because he just loves inflicting pain and Bill Murray just loves taking it. And it's a really like funny over-the-top scene where Steve Martin's just getting more and more annoyed that he can't actually hurt this guy. And the other film that we haven't really touched on that was sort of the original Harold Ramis-Bill Murray collaboration is Stripes. And I don't think that Stripes is anywhere near as good as Ghostbusters, but it's definitely noteworthy and still a really funny Bill Murray performance.
One other thing I wanted to mention, it's a terrible movie, but I kind of like the randomness of his cameo in Dumb and Dumber 2, where he plays a meth cook, like a roommate, and he spends the entire role in like a suit, like covering his face, and he doesn't have any lines of dialogue, he just kind of waves, and you have no idea it's Bill Murray until you read the end credits. Just the fact that he would agree to do that is just so Bill Murray.
Well, he did, yeah, and I mean, maybe he owed the Farrelly brothers a favor because they had worked together on Kingpin, of course. That's a good lead-in, Robin. Robin, tell me, what do you think is the worst use of Bill Murray?
Well, I haven't seen a lot of his really terrible movies. Like, I haven't seen, like, the Garfield movies or any of that stuff. But I think that a huge waste of them was actually the Ghostbusters reboot. I was just shocked at how lame and unfunny his cameo appearance was. Like, I watched it in a crowded theater, and I don't think anybody laughed at his role at all, which is shocking. Like, he plays, it seems like a clever idea that he would play the skeptic, the guy who doesn't believe in ghosts, but he just kind of shows up, says a bunch of lame lines, and they blow him out the window, and you don't find out what happens to them. You're kind of like, okay, did they get in trouble? Did they kill this guy or something? He just vanishes from the movie. So it's kind of like, how could a Ghostbusters reboot bring Bill Murray back in a cameo and not give him anything interesting to do? Like, I was just kind of shocked just how lame it was.
I absolutely agree. I considered the Ghostbusters reboot for my worst of pick, worst use of Bill Murray. for those very reasons. TK, what is the worst use of Bill Murray?
Have you guys seen Larger Than Life? Because it is a train wreck.
Oh, you saw it?
Oh, yeah, when it came out.
It's Bill Murray and an elephant, right?
It's so bad. It's so bad.
What's it actually about?
So, Bill Murray plays this motivational speaker, and him and his partner, who's played by Jeremy Piven, have to, they're trying to get enough motivational tour money so they can buy an infomercial for themselves to get themselves going national. And Murray's dad apparently passes away, and he has to claim what's left of his will, which he thinks is like a bunch of money. But it turns out the money is money owed for his dad's like only willed item, which is a elephant.
My God.
Yeah, it's
Bill Murray inherits an elephant, the movie.
Yeah, that's the movie.
One other thing you forgot to mention, though, is that it also has an early Matthew McConaughey role.
No so frigging way.
Yeah, I have no. I think he plays a truck driver in it or something like that. But it's like Bill Murray and Matthew McConaughey in a movie together should be awesome, but not this one.
Wow, I'm glad I skipped it. So I have seen Garfield, and that's my pick. You know, Garfield, maybe. It's just a really dumb movie, and I mean, apparently Bill Murray signed on to do it by mistake. Have you guys heard this?
Yeah, this story is amazing.
The director's name, is it Ethan Cohen? Let me look it up.
It's
here.
Joel
it's
Cohen,
Cohen
with an H.
Yeah,
Joel
Cohen.
It's Joel Cohen, with an H. And Bill Murray apparently thought it was Joel Cohen of the Coen brothers who wrote this Garfield movie, and that's why he agreed to do it. Only later to find out, this is the downside of like not, you know, reading the script in advance and not doing the contract and all that, is that you make a mistake like this. So Bill Murray wound up by accident doing the voice of Garfield and creating this weird kind of loop where Lorenzo Music, who was a voice actor, did the voice of Peter Venkman on the Ghostbusters cartoon, and he was also the voice of Garfield, and Bill Murray would go on to voice Garfield in the movie of Garfield. Weird. But regardless,
that's so crazy.
Yeah, it's strange, and the story of how Murray signed on is hilarious, but this movie sucks really bad, so don't bother. It's a waste of Bill Murray, in my opinion.
And Stephen Tobolowsky's in it, too. Like, it's a Groundhog Day reunion in the worst possible way.
Yeah. It is really bad. Anyway, do we have any final thoughts on the career of Bill Murray? His IMDb doesn't actually list him as having anything coming out this year, but next year he's going to be in a new Wes Anderson stop-motion movie called Isle of Dogs. But do you guys have any thoughts, like closing thoughts on Bill Murray?
I just realized, since we were talking about Garfield, he really does need to do a movie with the Coen brothers. That just sounds like it would be amazing if it happened for real.
Yeah, absolutely. I think The Monuments Men was another waste of Bill Murray. That movie was a big letdown. It had such a great trailer, really interesting premise, and a killer cast, but it just didn't really do anything with any of them. I mean, Bill Murray wasn't bad. It was just such a poorly constructed movie, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true. I remember when I predicted it would be Best Picture for like 2013, and then they delayed it till February of 2014, and I kind of saw why. It was mediocre.
Yep, no good. TK, do you have any final thoughts on Bill Murray?
I had no idea there was a new anime, a Wes Anderson movie coming out. It doesn't drop until 2018. I had no idea. This is the greatest day of my life.
So
that's fantastic.
You need to. There's no trailer yet, but there is a little on-set video with Wes Anderson and Edward Norton, where Wes Anderson introduces the movie, and you really need to watch it because it is extremely funny. So one final note: I just want to thank our listener Liz, who pushed this show idea on us. We were going to do another topic this week, but we're going to be doing that topic next week. We could not pass up the opportunity to talk about Bill Murray and Groundhog Day on Groundhog Day. So thank you, Liz, for that suggestion. And with that, It is time to play The Ticket Price is Right, the box office prediction game where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on last week's predictions. I'm still really happy that we're, like, back at the beginning. You know, the scores were reset at the beginning of the year, so the game, it's still anybody's game, even though somebody is starting to run away with the score. Last time we predicted the opening totals for Triple X, The Return of Xander Cage, and Split. And so, Triple X, TK, you won! Dude, you predicted it right on the money. You said it would make $20 million. Triple X made $20 million. Well
hey.
Done. But that puts you way out in the lead. You have a score of 3. And I won for Split. I had the high bid with $20 million. I said Split would make $20 million. It actually did incredibly well and made $40 million. So I got the point for that. So I have a score of 1, but TK is in the lead with 3, and Robin is at 0. What is going on?
The tide has turned.
Oh, this could be it, TK. This could be your year. Let's see how well this goes.
I'll just maintain this lead for as long as I can.
Not
this week, that long.
This week, oh boy. Not much is coming out, I gotta say. I haven't even seen the trailer for The Space Between Us, but this appears to be some sort of astronaut romance starring Asa Butterfield. Have you guys Have you heard about this?
I've seen the trailer a couple times, and the story is that this kid, an astronaut went into space not knowing she was pregnant, and this kid was born on Mars and has lived his entire life there, and he finally gets to go to Earth, but he only has a short time to live because since he was born in Mars' atmosphere, he can't handle the Earth's atmosphere for like a certain amount of time and stuff, but he doesn't care. He wants to live life on Earth, so he runs away, and for whatever reason, Gary Oldman is playing the NASA scientist who tries to recapture him and send him back to Mars. It looks as dumb as it sounds.
Yeah, and it's being dumped in the wasteland of February at the movie theater, so it doesn't seem like the studio has a lot of confidence in it either. It has a budget of $30 million, and Robin, you get first pick. How much do you think it's going to make opening weekend?
It also has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 8%, which doesn't bode well, so it hasn't got a lot of publicity, so I'm going to say it bombs. I'm going to go with $4
million. $4 million. It's going to bomb. I'm going to go higher than that, though. I'll say $8 million. TK, The Space Between Us.
Oh, I was going to go 7.5.
Oh, you could?
Let's do that.
7.5 million. Yeah. And then the other movie coming out this weekend, this is another, this just makes me laugh. Rings, the long-awaited sequel to The Ring. Rings, plural. I just keep thinking of onion rings. It makes me want onion rings whenever I see that title. Oh, yeah, Rings.
And there's actually, are they still using a videotape in this one?
I don't know, but something I did see in the trailer, because I watched the trailer for it, is you know those screens, like when you take a flight, now there are screens in the back of the seat in front of you that you can watch movies on? Well, yeah. There's a shot where the ring tape plays on a whole bunch of those on a flight.
Okay.
And when I saw that in the trailer, my first thought was, how did it make it there before somebody showed it in a movie theater? Like, you would think that the next logical step is like, okay, the first one, it's like on a videotape. But in the next one, they show it to a whole movie theater of people. Like, you'd think that would be the next logical step. How did it make it onto an airplane before it made it to a movie theater? Also, I mean, this will give you some indication of the quality here. I think this was originally supposed to come out in 2015, and then it got pushed to, like, around Halloween last year, and then it got pushed to February of this year. Not a good sign. So, Rings. It has a budget of $25 million. Robin, how much will it make opening weekend?
I think it'll do okay for one weekend and then fade. I'll go with $18
million. $18 million. I do not have the same confidence that you do. I think maybe $10 million. $10 million. TK?
I'll go in between and go at $15
million. Rings. We'll see if it rings true. That is not the dumb joke of the week. This,
because it bloody well should be the dumb joke of the week.
This is the dumb joke of the week. Recently, somebody broke into my place and stole everything I own except a deck of cards. I guess I'll just have to learn to deal with it. I really like that. I think that's really good. I'll just have to learn to deal with it.
You'll have to, TK, you'll have to learn to deal with the dumb joke of the week.
Yeah, TK, you'll just have to learn to deal with it.
Oh, yeah, I'm dealing with it by drinking profusely before this hits every podcast.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at the back row. You can contact TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com. Robin has all sorts of projects on the go. The Trail Went Cold can be found at trailwentcold.com, or you can find a link on the-back-row.com. And that podcast broadcasts every Wednesday. There's a new true crime episode waiting for you every Wednesday. And of course, Robin also has written a lot at the-back-row.com and on cracked.com and listfirst.com. So just Google Robin Warder and you can pretty much find everything he's doing. And it's a lot. And of course, I also edit and produce The Trail Went Cold. Trailwentcold.com, guys. You should listen to some of these episodes. And I post stuff on the-back-row.com. And if you want to see some of my short film work, you can find it at mcgillfoot.com. Basically, all of these links can be found at the back row. And you can contact me by emailing gill@the-back-row.com. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next week. Shouts from the Back Row is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The Shouts from the Back Row theme is composed by Vince Nightfeld.